So, I want you to imagine a town where, over the course of a single year, the local maternity ward welcomes, let's say, 1,300 newborns.
Okay.
But in that exact same year, the local cemeteries bury over 1,600 people.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so just looking at that math, that town is actively shrinking.
Exactly. But what happens when you take that exact same shrinking population and suddenly, I mean, almost overnight, inject a 15% increase in new residents over just 5 years?
You definitely do not get a balanced spreadsheet, that's for sure.
Right. You get a crisis, you get an environment where, success suddenly feels an awful lot like the walls are caving in.
Because the foundation of that town just, well, it wasn't designed for that kind of sudden weight.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate macroeconomic growing pain, really,
Yeah.
where this intense desire for expansion violently collides with the literal physical reality of infrastructure.
And today we are taking a deep dive into a place that is living inside that exact paradox right now. We're looking at the Canadian province of Prince Edward Island, or PEI.
Which is such a fascinating case study.
It really is. Our source material for this deep dive is a highly detailed episode of the Business Edge audio program. And our mission today is to unpack a really complex, often controversial labor of their economy, which is immigration.
Right, specifically looking at whether immigration is currently functioning as a growth strategy or, a growth constraint for the island.
Exactly. And before we get into the actual mechanics of this, I do need to be crystal clear with you. Immigration is an intensely politically charged topic.
Oh, absolutely.
There are incredibly strong, totally valid opinions on all sides. So, for this deep dive, our mission is strictly to report and analyze the economic arguments, the historical data, and, well, the specific perspectives presented by our source material.
Yeah, we're not taking a political side here.
No, not at all. We aren't endorsing any specific viewpoints, and we definitely aren't validating the source's critiques of the provincial or federal governments. Our goal is simply to break down the facts and the economic logic provided in the audio so you can understand the math behind what is happening.
And that distinction really matters. We're treating the source material as an analytical lens. We're exploring cause and effect, supply and demand, leaving the political commentary at the door.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really understand the current anxiety in PEI, I mean, the fear about overpopulation and the very genuine strain on public services, we first have to look at the historical ghost that has haunted the province for generations.
Right.
And that ghost is not runaway growth, it's actually stagnation.
Yeah, the source actually describes PEI's historical immigration policy as a pendulum.
A pendulum.
Yeah, one that swings wildly from total indifference to, sudden panic. Because if we look at the historical data they provide, it paints a picture of a region that has constantly struggled to keep its people.
Right, they had the numbers in there. In 1861, the province had a population of 80,857. And then 30 years later, in 1891, it rose to just over 109,000.
But then it slid backward.
Yeah.
By 1931, the population had fallen to 88,038.
Which is wild. They effectively lost decades of growth due to global wars and outmigration. And even as recently as 2011, the population was only sitting at like 145,855.
It's almost like PEI operated as a minor league training camp.
Oh, I like that analogy. Like a leaky bucket, basically.
Exactly. They would raise and educate a workforce and then just sit back and watch as the brightest, youngest talent packed up and left for larger economic markets.
Like Toronto or New England or California, where the opportunities were just deeper.
Right. And while that steady leakage of talent is a long-standing historical issue, the source highlights a current demographic time bomb that has really accelerated the timeline.
The aging population.
Yes, PEI is aging, and the speed of that aging is severe. From 2015 to 2025, the senior population in PEI increased by 42.2%.
Wow. Which, I mean, that brings us back to that jarring math we talked about at the top of the show. The source notes that PEI's natural increase has actually turned negative. Between July 2024 and June 2025, there were exactly 1,375 births across the entire province, compared to 1,620 deaths. So births are literally not replacing deaths.
You're looking at a natural decline of 245 people in a single year.
Right.
And this creates just a terrifying fiscal equation for a local government.
How so?
Well, you have a massive surge in a demographic that requires the highest levels of healthcare and social support, but they're simultaneously exiting the active labor force and, the primary tax base.
If I can deduce the broader picture here, the source emphasizes that for the first time ever, Canada's national population is expected to decline this year.
Yes, exactly.
So if the entire country is aging and federal transfer payments, which heavily fund provincial budgets, are tied directly to population size, aren't all these provinces essentially trapped in a zero-sum game?
They absolutely are.
Like, they must all be fighting each other for the exact same shrinking pool of youthful, tax-paying workers.
They are. And the stakes in that competition are basically existential for smaller economies. Because if a province like PEI fails to attract inward migration, the math is totally unforgiving.
Right. Without new, younger workers, household formation slows down.
The labor force hollows out. You lose the active, productive economic engine required to generate the tax revenue that actually pays for that 42.2% surge in seniors.
Man, so the entire system ends up trying to finance an expanding healthcare burden on the backs of a shrinking group of workers.
Exactly.
So that ticking demographic clock really forced the province's hand. They knew they needed people, they pushed aggressively for growth, and they absolutely got it.
Boy, did they.
But the whiplash from that success is what caused them to smash right into the infrastructure wall.
Yeah, the transition from desperate attraction to sudden saturation was incredibly abrupt. Historically speaking, PEI's recent growth has been just explosive.
The population hit 179,000 by July 2024.
And then surged to 182,657 by July 2025. Over a five-year period for 2020 to 2025, their growth rate was an astonishing 14.7%.
Which is huge.
It's one of the highest rates in the country, mm-hmm. largely driven by 2,843 immigrants arriving in just one year.
But the friction ignited because they failed to synchronize the arrival of those bodies with the physical capacity to actually absorb them.
Right.
According to the source, the province was highly effective at marketing itself and bringing people to the island, but they didn't lay the water pipes, they didn't construct the primary care clinics, or build the schools fast enough to support them.
You can see the direct fallout of this in their own internal projections, too.
Oh, yeah. PEI had a celebrated milestone goal of hitting 200,000 people by 2030. They recently had to push that target all the way back to 2035 simply because they have a massive cumulative housing shortfall.
And the source makes a vital distinction at this point. The core problem was never the sheer volume of immigrants.
Right.
The breakdown occurred in the mismatch.
Yeah.
It was the complete disconnect between their demographic policy and their infrastructure build-out capacity.
They treated population growth and urban planning as two separate silos rather than two gears turning the exact same machine.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The source points out a bizarre economic paradox in the housing market that is honestly hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, the oversupply issue.
Right. On one hand, you have a cumulative housing shortfall. There are physically not enough homes for the people who live there. Yet on the other hand, the source argues there is an economic oversupply in the housing market today that could cause apartment builders to go underwater.
It sounds contradictory.
Completely. How can you have a physical shortage of homes, but an economic oversupply at the exact same time?
Well, the paradox makes sense once you look at the mechanics of construction financing.
Okay, walk me through that.
Builders don't build based on the number of people who need homes. They build based on the number of people who can pay the rent required to make the building profitable.
Oh, right.
To get a loan for a massive apartment complex, a developer runs a pro forma calculation. They factor in the skyrocketing costs of lumber, concrete, labor, plus current high interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
So they might calculate that they need to charge, say, $2,000 a month for a one-bedroom apartment just to break even.
So if the province suddenly shifts its immigration policy and changes the demographic of who is arriving, or if the broader economy just cools down, the people who actually need those apartments can no longer afford that $2,000 break-even point.
Exactly. The physical demand is still there, but the economic demand basically vanishes.
Wow.
The rental rates in the market naturally recede to what people can actually afford.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are a tenant, that sounds like a win.
Sure.
But if you are the builder who borrowed $30 million based on those higher rental projections, your brand new building is now losing money every single month. Your asset is underwater.
It perfectly illustrates how chaotic, unsynchronized planning just punishes capital investment. When developers get burned by policy whiplash, they simply stop building.
Right, which only worsens the physical shortage for the next decade.
So the cranes stop moving, the builders freeze their projects, and the provincial government, looking at this sudden gridlock of unbuilt homes, packed schools, and overwhelmed hospitals, decides the only immediate lever they have is to slam the door shut.
Yeah, they shift into what the source calls a triage model.
Triage, like in an ER.
Exactly. The government looked at the immediate stress points in their system and decided to drastically restrict who was allowed to come in.
Since January 2025, right.
Yeah, they utilized the Atlantic Immigration Program, which is essentially a fast-track partnership between the federal government and the East Coast provinces to let local employers directly recruit global talent.
Yeah.
And they just clamped it down.
They limited new endorsements almost exclusively to three high-demand sectors, which were healthcare, construction, and manufacturing. So let me play devil's advocate for the listener here, because honestly, that sounds completely logical. If your hospitals are bursting at the seams and your construction projects are stalled because you don't have tradespeople, isn't it undeniable common sense to say, hey, we are only going to invite doctors to staff the clinics and carpenters to build the houses?
It seems like it.
Why does the source criticize this triage policy as being myopic and defensive?
What's fascinating here is the source draws a crucial line between a vacancy-filling tool and a long-term growth model.
A vacancy-filling tool.
Right. In a 12-month administrative cycle, triage makes perfect sense. You are plugging holes in a sinking ship. But the danger is that an economy is a complex interdependent ecosystem.
So it's kind of like a technology company firing its entire research and development department just so they can afford to hire more customer service reps.
Exactly.
Like, yes, you might answer today's angry phone calls faster, but you have absolutely no new products to sell 5 years from now.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. A thriving, scaling regional economy requires way more than just nurses and factory workers.
Right.
It needs retail managers to run the storefronts. It needs logistics coordinators to move goods. It requires digital workers to modernize local businesses. And crucially, it needs early stage entrepreneurs and franchise buyers.
Because those are the people who arrive with capital, right?
Right.
They start a new sector, hire local workers, and organically expand the consumer demand base.
Yes. The source argues that by treating immigration purely as a short-term triage tool to fix today's bottlenecks, the government is quietly starving tomorrow's economy.
They're filtering out the families whose long-term economic contributions, like buying homes, starting businesses, paying property taxes for 30 years, are far more valuable than the single job code they entered the country with.
Exactly. Oh. A small province with a shrinking natural population just cannot manage its economy in reactive 12-month defensive cycles without underscaling its future.
Which brings us to the pivotal question. If constant triage is just a Band-Aid, and the pendulum swinging back and forth is actively destroying investment, what does an actual cure look like?
Well, the source outlines a strategic blueprint for a sustainable balance, and they anchor it with a number that caused quite a bit of controversy.
An aspirational target of 400,000 people.
Yeah.
But the source is quick to clarify that 400,000 isn't a terrifying prediction for next year's census. It doesn't actually matter if it takes 50 years or 200 years to reach that population.
Right. The logic behind setting a massive, long-term, aspirational target is that it finally forces the government to map out the physical infrastructure properly.
If you know your endpoint is 400,000 residents, you design your water treatment facilities, your power grids, your highway overpasses completely differently from the start.
You're working backward from a permanent goal line rather than constantly scrambling to bolt new pieces onto an old system.
Okay, so if we connect this to the bigger picture, how do they actually get there? Because the source details a 6-point cohesive strategy to get to that goal line without breaking the province in the process.
Right. The very first point, the first layer of this strategy, is establishing an annual absorptive capacity framework.
Absorptive capacity.
Yes. Instead of politicians picking an immigration quota out of thin air or reacting to public pressure, the province needs to explicitly link its population targets to hard, measurable data.
Like how many new housing units were actually completed this year? What is the current rental vacancy rate? Do the public schools physically have open desks?
Exactly. You only bring in the volume of people that your infrastructure can mathematically absorb in that 12-month period.
But bringing people in is only half the equation. Point two from the source says PEI has to manage exactly who is coming by treating their immigration pathways like an investment portfolio.
Portfolio design, yeah.
Yes, you allocate a safe, short-term portion of your nominations to fix immediate crises, the triage for healthcare and construction, but you legally protect a defined portion of your intake for broader, long-term ecosystem builders.
Right. You keep the door permanently open for international entrepreneurs, business succession buyers who can take over local shops when the older owners retire, and young families who intend to plant roots.
And speaking of roofs, that leads directly into point three, which highlights perhaps the most frustrating friction point in this entire system: retention.
Oh, yeah. The source is incredibly blunt about this.
Very blunt. If an immigrant goes through the arduous process of arriving, navigating the settlement system, and then leaves the province for Ontario or Alberta after 2 years, that is not just a personal life choice. It is a fundamental policy failure.
It is policy leakage.
Policy leakage, exactly.
It's a massive loss of upfront investment. The province spends capital integrating that worker, and then another region reaps the decades of economic benefit.
So to fix this leakage, the source argues PEI needs far better credential recognition.
Yeah, you cannot have highly trained foreign doctors driving taxis because the local medical boards refuse to streamline their licensing. They also need faster employment pathways for spouses so the whole family feels economically secure.
Point four is about the physical footprint. The source argues that housing policy must be viewed as economic policy. Often, the political narrative pits housing against immigration, creating this binary where voters are told they can't have immigrants because they don't have houses.
The source completely flips that logic.
Yeah, they argue the government must aggressively accelerate construction permitting, embrace prefabricated and modular builds that bypass traditional labor shortages, and mandate worker housing near major employment centers.
And crucially, that housing and growth can't just be piled into Charlottetown.
Which brings us to point five.
Right, Charlottetown is the capital city, and much like Toronto or Halifax, it acts as a natural magnet for everyone arriving. But if all the population growth concentrates in one single urban center, you massively intensify the housing and infrastructure pressure there while leaving the rural areas to age out and decline.
So the blueprint demands a regional population strategy. The province has to deliberately funnel growth to smaller communities like Summerside.
But to do that, they have to ensure those towns have the high-speed broadband, the primary care facilities, and the industrial anchors to actually attract and retain newcomers.
You can't just tell people to live in the countryside. You have to build the economic gravity to keep them there.
Exactly.
Finally, point six. All of this relies on PEI actually having the steering wheel, which they currently don't. The source insists that the province needs to negotiate aggressively with Ottawa.
Because the federal government sets strict limits on provincial nominee programs, which dictate how many people the province can select themselves.
PEI needs to demand more control over those allocations, tying their requests directly to the absorptive capacity they've proven they have.
Oh, and the source makes it a point to add that the province must clamp down hard on bad actors and employers who abuse the immigration system.
Because those abuses destroy the public's trust in the entire mechanism.
Right. When you look at that entire strategic shift.
Yeah.
I mean, from measuring capacity to balancing the portfolio to spreading out the geographic footprint, it represents a profound change in posture.
It really does.
It is moving a regional economy from a stance of fear and constraint to a stance of coordinated, disciplined ambition.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? If you step back from the specific policies of PEI, the source presents what they call the two truths of the province.
Okay.
Truth number one. PEI cannot absorb unmanaged rapid population growth without inflicting severe consequences on its infrastructure and its citizens.
Fair.
But truth number two, it also cannot protect its economic future by quietly starving its labor force, its tax base, and its entrepreneurial pipeline.
And that tension resonates far beyond one island in Canada. Whether you are managing a growing small business, sitting on a community zoning board, or running a regional government, ignoring your long-term capacity requirements out of short-term fear always leaves massive potential on the table.
If you suppress growth purely out of caution, you don't actually stay safe. You just slowly age into irrelevance. The demographic clock continues to tick whether you build the houses or not.
And there's a vital reframing the source uses here that completely changes the math. In public discourse, we so often talk about population growth merely as a headcount.
Right.
We view people as a tally of liabilities, you know, another car on the road, another patient taking up a hospital bed, another child needing a desk in a school.
But the source pushes back on that by reminding us that capital comes in many forms. We are obsessed with financial capital, but human capital and intellectual capital are just as critical. When you bring new people into a region, you are importing knowledge, innovation, and fresh consumer demand. Without external capital flowing in, a local economy is just endlessly recirculating the same government money. It isn't actually expanding.
If we stop viewing a growing population merely as a burden on existing infrastructure and start viewing it as the deliberate importation of human and intellectual capital, the mandate completely shifts.
Failing to build the housing and the roads isn't just a failure of city planning. It is a catastrophic failure to invest in your own economic engine. You are leaving the machinery of your next generation's prosperity sitting out in the rain to rust.
It really makes you wonder about the long-term implications of this global demographic shift.
How do you mean?
Well, if human capital is truly the most valuable asset a region can possess, and the national birth rates are dropping everywhere, we might be moving toward a future where provinces or even individual cities have to start acting like professional sports franchises.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, they will be forced to scout, recruit, and fiercely bid against each other on a global stage to draft the best young talent to their home turf. Because the math is clear. You know, the global draft pool is shrinking fast, and the cities that refuse to compete will simply be left behind.
What a fascinating way to look at the construction happening in your own backyard. It really does come down to a choice between managing your ambition or being managed by your fears. We want to thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the math and mechanics of growth.
Thank you for listening. It is a complex ecosystem, and breaking down the gears behind it is always a rewarding exercise.
We will see you next time. But as you go about your week, keep that tension in mind. Are the systems and communities you rely on every day actively building for the reality of tomorrow, or are they just frantically trying to keep up with yesterday?